This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, December 11th, 2009. From New York City, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, a small group of island nations demands stronger action on climate change.
The stakes have been raised, as it were, in terms of trying to get a strong outcome from Copenhagen.
In Uruguay, a bill passes that allows people to choose their gender identity. And we'll go to Chile, where the ruling center-left party faces a serious challenge in this weekend's elections. Those stories and more right after the headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Kenneth Feinberg, the so-called White House pay czar, today revealed new executive salary caps for four companies that received large government bailouts. Caps on the salaries of the top 25 executives were put in place earlier. The new caps affect the next 75 employees down the line. These employees at Citigroup, GM, GMAC, and AIG will be limited to a base salary of $500,000. In other financial news, the House of Representatives has passed the largest financial reform regulation since the Great Depression by a vote of 223-202. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, the legislation was weakened in the final days before passage.
The reform bill would create safeguards to ensure banks don't become too big to fail. But a last-minute measure was included in the bill that would allow states to sidestep the federal regulations. They could exempt banks from the stricter guidelines. The legislation also creates a new, separate agency to protect consumers who make financial transactions like using credit cards and buying homes. Ed Mierzwinski is with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group.
The Consumer Protection Agency would have only one job, enforcing the consumer protection laws. Right now, banks pick and choose their regulator.
Again, last-minute negotiations to ensure enough support for the bill created exemptions. Car buyers and student loan recipients will not be covered by the agency. Republicans and the financial industry opposed the bill. The Senate will take up the measure probably early next year. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Across the Atlantic, the French, German, and British governments are cooperating on banking reforms that could turn out to be surprisingly radical. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
France and Germany are supporting British Prime Minister Gordon Brown's super tax on bankers' bonuses, which will claim 50% of one-off payments over $40,000. France will impose the same tax on their banks. Anticipating a similar clampdown by the Obama administration, Goldman Sachs has already taken steps to suspend cash payouts for its top staff this year. However, German Chancellor Angela Merkel prefers a Tobin-style tax. It targets speculative cross-border currency transactions. She and Gordon Brown are attempting to persuade leaders to endorse the policy that has been strongly advocated by global justice campaigners for decades. The hope is the tax would raise revenue and protect national economies from the consequences of risky speculation. But few countries are willing to impose such a system without international agreement. So far, the Obama administration has opposed it. But European governments are now pushing them hard. The European Union may even consider implementing a Tobin tax for euro transactions. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
A Palestinian mosque in the West Bank has been burned and vandalized, a sign of the steadily growing tensions between Jewish settlers and Palestinians in the region. From Hebrew graffiti scrawled on the walls of the mosque, Palestinians believe the act was perpetrated by Jewish settlers angered by the Israeli settlement freeze. Earlier this week, thousands of settlers staged a mass protest in Jerusalem. The Israeli army is investigating the incident. Refugee numbers in Yemen are ballooning as residents flee fighting in the northern part of the country. Andrei Mahecic of the UN Refugee Agency says this is causing problems in refugee camps.
Over the past month alone, the IDP population of Al-Mazraq 1 camp has doubled. There are now some 21,000 IDPs living in a camp initially designed to shelter up to 10,000 people, and overcrowding is presently the top concern for us.
The UN says overcrowding makes it difficult to distribute food and supplies in the camp. The Yemeni government has been in heated battles with the al-Houthi rebels for the past 5 months. And finally, police raided a student-occupied administrative building at the University of California, Berkeley, early Friday morning. Dozens have been arrested. The students were protesting a recent decision to substantially raise tuition rates in the California university system. Elias Martinez is a political science and international relations major at UC Berkeley. He came to the building as soon as he heard of the arrests.
And it seemed like everything there, at least when I was there, it was peaceful. Students were cleaning up after themselves. They brought food to give to students who were studying. But there was a police presence. There has been, I believe, the entire week. And it was surprising to see them come in at 5 in the morning. And I saw some students being escorted out barefoot in their underwear. It seemed like a huge surprise that they came in to arrest students.
The students had occupied the building for 5 days as part of their Open University initiative. Martinez said the arrests today could mobilize more students to participate in other nonviolent actions to protest the actions of the administration and police. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. At the UN Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen today, a coalition of island states, many of whom are expected to be hit worst by climate change, released a proposal which demands vastly stronger action than what so far has been considered in the official talks. The Alliance of Small Island States calls for limiting the maximum global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius and the carbon content of the atmosphere to 350 parts per million, about 10% less than it is today. Antonio Lima of Cape Verde is vice chair of the alliance.
Some of our countries, if we go beyond 1.5, are going to disappear. And we are experimenting now, at this moment, the effects of and the impact of the climate change.
Lima was addressing a crowd of organizers planning tomorrow's mass demonstrations. The plan is part of Klimaforum, the parallel conference taking place in Copenhagen, which also issued a declaration. They'll deliver it to visiting leaders next week. Among other things, it calls for industrialized countries to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 40% by the year 2020 and for a complete phase out of fossil fuels within 30 years. And to take a deeper look at the proposal from the island nations and other developments at the conference, we're joined from Copenhagen by Dr. Salim Al-Huk. He's a senior fellow with the International Institute for Environment and Development's Climate Change Group. He's also a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you.
The first week of the conference is winding up. What's your assessment of the progress so far?
Well, during the first week, we had a little bit of a setback initially when the Danish government was accused of having prepared some sort of a prepackaged political agreement text, which had to then be withdrawn, and the negotiators were allowed to continue with the negotiations. But in the last day or so, we've had a fairly dramatic new development, which is a proposal from the group of small island states to have a binding Copenhagen Protocol coming out of here. By the end of next week, which is something that many countries thought may not be possible, but the small island states are going to push for. So the stakes have been raised, as it were, in terms of trying to get a strong outcome from Copenhagen. It remains to be seen whether that will be achieved or not.
Another thing that has emerged from this first week is the importance of funding. Your organization, the International Institute for Environment and Development, came out with a report just before the conference began in which you called funding a key to breaking this deadlock between different countries' expectations. China and some African countries are calling for rich nations to give a half to 1% of their GDP to deal with climate change in poor countries. How do you see this working?
Well, the agreement so far has identified four areas that need to be developed further if we're going to solve the climate change problem. The first one is to reduce emissions by all countries, but particularly the rich countries and the large developing countries. The second one is to have adaptation support for the poor, most vulnerable countries. The third one is to have technology transfer for both mitigation or reducing emissions as well as adaptation or coping with the impacts. And fourth one is finance, which is going to be needed for all the other three, mitigation, adaptation, and technology. So finance is a key issue. The requirements of finance are in the hundreds of billions of dollars a year, whether that comes out of GDP payments from governments or it comes out of other sources like cap and trade revenues, auction revenues. This is something that will be discussed and hopefully be resolved here by the end of the next week.
I noticed some of the headlines are calling it aid, and delegates from developing countries have made it a point to call it climate finance instead of aid. What's the difference?
The difference is aid is given by rich countries to poor countries out of a sense of charity or solidarity. There is no real obligation. There is a self-imposed or promised target of 0.7% of a country's GNP, which was made 30 years ago. Only a handful of the rich countries have ever reached that target. Most of them haven't. The United States is probably the worst culprit in terms of reaching that target. And there's no way to hold them to it. It's up to them whether they give or not. It's up to them who they give it to. The climate change issue is very different. This is a pollution agreement, and these are obligations from the polluters to pay the victims of pollution. And therefore, we are asking for climate finance to be in a different category, particularly the developing countries are, which needs to be under the control of the UN, and countries that are obliged to pay need to do it as an obligation under a treaty, which is very different from what aid is.
I see. And that would ensure that the financing is legally binding. Finally, Dr. Salim, you are the co-founder of the Bangladesh Center for Advanced Studies, which was founded in the mid-1980s. You've been working in this field for more than two decades now. How do you see this movement at this point?
I think it's grown enormously. When we started looking at impacts of climate change in the, I would say, early 90s, it was a subject that most people were A, not aware of, and B, even if they were aware of, did not realize the significance of. On the other hand, now, over the last two decades, the level of awareness has increased enormously. The presence of civil society actors in Copenhagen, not just from Europe or nearby, but from all over the world is enormous. As I said, there's more than 20,000 people in Copenhagen, a large chunk of them from Africa, Asia, Latin America, and from North America as well. And that is in itself a very good thing, because this is a global problem. It needs global solutions. It needs the global leaders to act. But more than that, it needs everybody on the planet to do their bit.
We've been speaking with Dr. Salim Al-Huq, Senior Fellow with the Climate Change Group at the International Institute for Environment and Development. He's also a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And to hear more of the interview with Dr. Salim Al-Huq on climate change and why he calls it the defining issue of the next century, go to fsrn.org. Finally, an update from Copenhagen. The UK's Guardian newspaper is reporting that 68 protesters have been arrested today in actions ahead of demonstrations planned for this weekend. Stay tuned to FSRN on Monday for more coverage of the demonstrations. This Sunday, Chileans go to the polls to elect a successor to Chile's first female president, Michelle Bachelet. This election campaign may end the Concertación coalition of center-left parties that has governed Chile since the return to democracy in 1990. From Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garretón has more.
Rafael Cabrera is a cab driver who gets a feel for the pulse of the country through the customers he drives each day. He says the Chileans he talks to are paying little attention to the presidential campaign.
De los políticos.
No, el sistema, porque si tú ves el sistema de evaluación que hay...
They're tired of politicians, not the political system. If you look, the president has perhaps the largest approval rating of all Latin America. So we see two opposite poles. There's a large gap between the approval rating the president has and the disapproval politicians face from voters. People are tired of the classic politician who believes politics is a monarchy.
One reason for the political apathy could be the lack of new faces in the political system. The candidates are a former president, now senator, seeking re-election, a candidate who has contested three presidential elections, and a one-time senator. A third candidate is a Congress member seeking to become the youngest president in two centuries. And the fourth candidate is a former cabinet minister who held a number of posts. Leading all polls is right-wing billionaire Sebastián Piñera, who is making his third run at the presidency. Piñera owns Chile's main airline carrier, a TV network, and holds multiple stakes in many businesses, including banks and private health clinics. Piñera is calling for change, but supports keeping Bachelet's social policies.
We will strengthen job creation programs. We will strengthen the vouchers that our most needy families receive. We will strengthen the programs against poverty. And we will extend our hand to our long-abandoned middle class. That will be the heart and soul of our future government. I invite you all not to fall prey to terror campaigns. I call upon all to have a clean campaign that captures the best of what lies in the heart and soul of all Chileans.
Piñera is followed by the ruling center-left candidate Senator Eduardo Frei, a Christian Democrat and former president from 1994 to 2000. Frei also wants to continue Bachelet's policies, but says after the economic meltdown, the country needs more state intervention in the economy and other sectors of society.
I'm extremely proud of my country. I feel great pride when I see our president being widely praised for what she has done. That is the road we must follow, but there is much to do. We need true labor reform, a strong and powerful state, because the market does not solve all of Chile's problems. We want to protect the middle class because they deserve it. We want to protect our seniors. That is what I am fighting for.
Also in the race is 35-year-old Congress member Marco Enriquez Ominami, who left the Socialist Party after it decided to support Christian Democrat candidate Frei. Enriquez Ominami has mounted a successful independent campaign, draining important support from the Concertación coalition. The Communist Party is fielding a former Socialist Party member and former cabinet minister in the Concertación governments, Jorge Arrate. He decided to leave the coalition because of its connection to business interests and support of neoliberal economic policies. Voters will also elect the entire lower house of Congress and half of the Senate. Yet the electorate does not seem convinced in the candidates and their platforms.
I will continue supporting the Concertación, despite the fact that I do not identify myself with them. I believe they have been a successful coalition that has given governability to Chile. The right does not give me confidence. I want the Concertación to win.
I will vote for Frei. I like Arrate a lot, but voting for him is losing one's vote, because I don't want Piñera to win. I don't trust Piñera, so my vote is for Frei.
I have decided on a candidate from the right. I am pleased with my decision. This country needs change. We have to see what a different government can do.
I think this will be the first election since the end of the democratic transition, marking the end of the Concertación governments. This election is interesting on two grounds: the end of the transition and the beginning of the old, historic, three-way fight between right, center, and left. I believe Piñera will win the election, and the Concertación will break up, and the three-way right, center, left division will start again.
Despite voter apathy and complacency, there will be many at the polls. In Chile, voting is mandatory. Jorge Garretón, FSRN, Santiago.
And in Uruguay, the parliament has approved a bill that allows citizens to choose their gender identity. This means any citizen can decide which gender should appear on their IDs as long as they prove with the witness that they have lived under such sexual identity for the past 4 years. FSRN's Marcos Federman has more.
The law is a result of 2 years of work by a diverse team of sociologists, anthropologists, lawyers, and members of the LGBT community. Senator Margarita Perkovic from the government coalition Frente Amplio introduced the bill last December, and after a unanimous vote, the president signed it into law on November 11th. Maria Paz Gorostizaga is with the sexual diversity NGO Ovejas Negras, or Black Sheep. Paz, who helped to craft the bill, says as a transsexual, she experienced discrimination and wanted to help others like her.
Me comí muchos calabozos por mi identidad de género de adolescente.
When I was a teenager, I spent many nights in the police station's prison cell just because of my gender identity. The organization I belong to, Black Sheep, is now working internationally, including in Argentina, Paraguay, Chile, and Spain. Why? Because within the gay, lesbian, trans, and bisexual community, transvestites and transgenders are the most vulnerable of all. In Latin America, our life expectancy is only 33 years. Concerning our demand for the right to choose our gender identity, we are not asking for anything crazy.
Under the new law, any citizen who has lived the life of the opposite gender for the past 4 years can change his or her gender identity on official documents like IDs and passports. Uruguay has a record of being on the forefront of socially progressive legislation. Divorce has been legal since 1907. Women won the right to vote in 1932, and the government legalized same-sex civil unions at the national level in 2007, the only country so far in Latin America that provides this right. Diego Sempola is also a member of the advocacy group Black Sheep.
Y creo que cada vez más organizada y cada vez más empoderada, porque en la medida que este año
I believe, as a community, we are getting more organized and more empowered. This year, we were successful with a few legal demands we had, and this leads to more and more people getting out of the closet and exercising their citizenship. This year, the Sexual Diversity March brought together 10,000 people. You have to consider that we only had 1,000 people when we first organized a march in 2005. So we multiplied by 10 the amount of people participating in events that gave visibility to equal rights.
Eran unas 1000 personas, o sea que multiplicamos por 10 la cantidad de gente que está participando en espacios de visibilidad y de defensa de sus derechos.
Uruguay is the first country in Latin America to legalize the right to choose your official gender identity. A similar proposal is being promoted by some Congress members in Argentina, but it is not currently on the parliament's agenda. The United Nations General Assembly declared choosing gender identity as a human right in 2006. This declaration was supported by most of Europe and the Americas, including the US, and also by some Asiatic and African countries. Arab nations declared their opposition. The UN recommends that countries that signed the declaration change their laws accordingly. Marcos Federman, FSRN.
This week marks the 28th anniversary of the incarceration of author and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal, whose commentaries are heard on FSRN. Abu-Jamal was arrested in Philadelphia on December 9, 1981, for the shooting death of police officer Daniel Faulkner. A jury unanimously sentenced him to death, but Abu-Jamal has always maintained his innocence. Prison Radio producer Noel Hanrahan interviewed Abu-Jamal about entering his 29th year of incarceration.
What does 29 years mean?
There are no words. There are no words. Yeah. No words could properly capture it. There are no words. There are no words.
Even though you're there, why have you stayed true to writing or reporting or being a journalist?
Because there is a crying need for it. If someone in the so-called free world were doing it, then I would not have to. I mean, you know the old saying they used to say, I think it was a series, there's a million stories in the naked city. Well, there are a million stories in every prison in America. But it is so rarely told, rarer still to be written about with any, you know, real compassion or integrity, revelation. Most people, when they think about prison, they think about Oz or something like that, you know. But that's fictional. That isn't even close to the real deal. The real deal shows us that most American prisons look far more like an Abu Ghraib than they do in Oz. I know that a lot of guys watch Oz when it was on, when we had HBO over here, and they would laugh because they said, damn, they wish it was like that. They wish it was like that, but it ain't even close. It ain't even close. It is a hidden world that's meant to be hidden, and so that's a great motivation to write and to tell the stories that no one else will tell.
What does it mean that 1 in 46 people will do time? What does it mean that our world is defined by we spend more in California on prisons than on education?
Well, I think about Roosevelt's statement about when he was talking about war, and of course he was talking about the military-industrial complex, and he was saying words to the effect like, for every bomber and for every plane and for every tank that takes food out of the mouth of hungry people and poor people, this is the prison-industrial complex. And I just read an interesting article in the Monthly Review. The title is The Penal State in the Age of Crisis. You know, I'm surprised sometimes when I read some of this stuff because it makes the point that a new prison opens in America every week. Think about that. Every week. And if you look at the population of American prisons and you compare it to other countries, say like China or India, you know, China has, I think, 4, maybe 5 times America's population. India, at least 4, 3 or 4 times. Well, America in prisons like 7 times China, and I think 8 times India. So, and the national crime rate, for all intents and purposes, peaked around 1990 and has been plummeting ever since. I mean, if you look at the actual data, so how do you have this kind of crazed increase in incarceration when national crime rates are plummeting? And you know it has nothing to do with crime. It has something to do with kind of the throwaway effect of capitalism and the industry of prisons and how, you know, politicians can, you know, pimp that industry.
You know, when the Super Predator article came out, it reminded me of your articles.
Yeah, I remember.
Just how they theorize in order to create this commodity.
Right, right. And then, say, 10 years later, they come out and say, oops, we were wrong. You know, when that super predator theory came out, states rushed to change their juvenile codes because they believed, you know, the eggheads in the academy. And so they changed their juvenile codes and made them far closer to the crime codes and the penal codes. And thousands of kids were socked away with adult sentences and so forth. Pennsylvania has the highest number of juvenile lifers in the country. When the intellectuals and the right-wing cranks come out and then they say, well, I was wrong, you know, 7, 8 years ago, does that mean that the law changes? No. Those kids are in a hell that Kafka could not dream of.
That was Prison Radio's Noel Hanrahan interviewing Mumia Abu-Jamal. This week marks the 28th anniversary of his incarceration. And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Today's headlines editor was Jess Burns. Washington, D.C. editor was Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Scott Pham and Antonio Ortiz. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.